Then do the Teresa evenings on the courts, and it was a wonderful, wonderful contribution to contemplative life and really educating people about mystical life and mystics and saints down the centuries. So Kim has been a contemplative since her youth and joined the WCC in the early 90s, and she guides the Accord Medicine International School for the World Community of Christian Education. She's an international speaker. She just come back to the United States for a month or 3 weeks.
3 weeks. That was long enough.
Speaking all across the United States. I'll show you speak a bit more about. I think mainly on Dancing with Your Shadow, but many other areas, of course. And her book, Dancing with Your Shadow, came out a couple of years ago. And
1 year ago.
Sorry?
1 year
ago.
Yeah. Wonder. Said it's a little baby.
Little contribution to psychology and the deeper spiritual life. A very important book in that whole area. A wonderful person as well.
You can see we're friends, can't you?
So just a few practical things. Any donations, welcome. You know where the loos are. Do make yourself tea and coffee in the break. It's a good website. So the next talk will be very interesting. Pamela Chidacray is going to be speaking in June on sacred art and contemplation. Francis and Claire, the devotion art, and St. Francis and St. Claire. And Pamela is a very well known medieval art historian. So we'll have to come up with them, we'll organise. So we'll be a real piece of knowledge and understanding of that area. And anyone else who thinks would like to come, very welcome. It's an open forum. And there are other copies of the program at the back for you. So, housekeeping. So, and the structure of the morning is about an hour-ish, hour and a quarter, then a break. And then you're going to leave us some stuff.
Then you're going to get nice texts to look at together. So, there you go. Just read that reading again, Amanda, because that really sums it up beautifully. Well done.
A brother who was living among the other brothers asked Abba Basarion, "What should I do?" The old man replied, "Be silent and do not measure yourself against the others."
And really, I could go home now, because that's the teaching of the desert. Be silent and do not measure yourself against others. It is the letting go of the achievement part of our ego, the one who wants esteem, power, control, and to just go in the silence and discover who you truly are. That's the teaching, folks. That is the main thing to it. So my plan this morning then is to first tell you a bit about the Desert Fathers so that we set them in context. Why did they end up in the desert? And who were they? And were they all the same? And then after the break, we then have, I've got a handout with various of their sayings, and through the sayings we will then discover really what is their teaching. Yeah. Of course I have not specially selected them, but there you go. So in the 4th century many Christians moved into the desert around Alexandria. It's basically the area north of Cairo. And they really did that because they wanted to lead an authentic Christian life. Now you may well ask, well, why on earth do you have to go into the desert to do that? Well, that is where the environment dictates what we do. In the 4th century, Christianity had become the religion of the empire. Yeah, do you remember the Melvian Bridge episode with the Emperor Constantine, where he had that vision, and then from 313 onwards, Christianity was no longer persecuted. It was, in fact, it became the state religion. And the point was that from 3 million Christians, it became 30 million Christians in just a few years. Because now, instead of it being dangerous to be a Christian, it was very advantageous to be one. Because the Emperor Constantine was chucking money at the church. There is no other way of putting it. And in fact, St. John Chrysostom said, "Plagues teeming with untold mischief have come upon the churches. The primary offices have become marketable. Excessive wealth, enormous power, and luxury are destroying the integrity of the church." Now, if you think in the first 3 centuries, churches were basically house groups. People secretly got together. In Alexandria, there was a proper church because no one wanted trouble in Alexandria because it was the breadbasket of the empires. So practically only there was a proper church. Everything else was in people's homes. But now you got proper churches and proper bishops. But there weren't many bishops before either. Now, not only that, but we are at the end of the Roman Empire. And the end of a civilization always implies decadence. Yeah, so it's an interesting point there for our present life. And in fact, Thomas Merton said society was regarded by the Desert Fathers as a shipwreck from which each individual man had to swim for their life. It was incredibly decadent. There are lovely stories where, women are only dressed in jewelry, nothing else. You know, our time is Puritan compared to what things were like in the early 4th century. So true Christians wanted out. They didn't want that environment. They felt that environment really played on their own negative instincts. They were tempted. So they wanted out. They wanted to do what St. Paul said: "Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind." That was their motto. That is what Amanda pointed out. Your mind is renewed by going into the silence. And the ego part of it, the excessive ego part of it, is the one that is attracted by the world and conforms to this world. Now, the other important aspect is that early Christians, being a Christian was being a potential martyr. It was very, very important because of Christ dying on the cross for what he believed in. They very much saw martyrdom as a way of following Christ. Yeah, this was very, very important. And in fact, the early Christian desert monks and nuns saw, in fact, going into the desert as an alternative way of martyrdom. They called it white martyrdom as opposed to red martyrdom of the true martyrs. We cannot now anymore imagine how influential those martyrs were. Yeah, and how influential the early Christians were. They didn't go out evangelizing. They drew other people by their behavior, by their behavior of caring and loving and not being grasping, not asking for money, for looking after the ill and the poor. And the martyrs as well, the two together, were really the recruitment aspect without it ever being intended to be so. So it was really through their behavior. And in fact, in Pacomius's life, Pacomius is one of the desert fathers who started, was the very first to start proper monasteries for men and women in the desert. And he said, faith increased greatly in the churches in every land, and monasteries and places for ascetics began to appear for those who were the first monks had seen the endurance of the martyrs. So that's an aspect we mustn't actually lose track of. But then, why go in the desert? Well, you tell me. Why go into the desert? What is the, why, how? What's special about the desert? There is something purifying about the desert, quite right. You have to strip down to essentials, absolutely. What else? Was it ever done before? Was that the first time people went into the desert? Christian?
They went to Mount Carmel in the Old Testament.
Exactly, exactly. And Elijah? In the desert. Moses? In the desert. It was a tradition that if you wanted to go deeper in your faith, you went into the desert. So that was already an important settlement. But also the desert, as you were saying, was an example to purify. Now, normally I do PowerPoint, but we weren't ready for that yet, which is fine. It just means, imagine just for a minute, close your eyes and imagine a desert landscape. What does that do to you? What is the desert?
It worries me. It worries me because there's nothing else to look at but myself
there. Ha! Wonderful! That's exactly why the desert fathers and mothers went. There were no distractions. Only your own thoughts were there. Brilliant. Yes. What else?
Silence.
Pure.
Silence. Sense of God.
Wonderful. Silence and stillness. And if you've ever been in the desert, there is no place on earth that is more silent than the desert. It's wonderful. Stillness. There are not rustling leaves, hardly anything. And a sense of God. Yes. Yes. The early Christians very much saw the desert as a manifestation of God. Why? Tell me why. Why was it so much like an image of God?
It's lots of sky, it's one thing.
And exactly.
And the way that the water is not is underneath.
Wonderful. I'd never thought of that one. Yes. There is water underneath, although it is dry on top. There is the immensity of the sky. Yeah. And that, the awesomeness, the immensity, made people feel very much that this, if at all you needed an image, this was God manifest, the unmanifest manifest. before the Desert Fathers already, we've seen, you know, the prophets and everyone went to the desert, but ordinary people already started doing that in the 3rd century. Because in a way, there comes in our lives, when we're on the spiritual path, there comes a need for silence and solitude. Yeah? And we seek that, either external or internal or both. Yeah? And the same thing happened in the 4th century, 3rd century. They were called the apotaktikoi. Yeah? These were people who already, they lived in the towns or on the outskirts or little bit way in the desert, and they already started to live a life of dedication to prayer and dedication to helping others, teaching others, and a solitary, often a celibate life. But that was not necessarily, we'll come back to that after the break, that was not necessarily a property that was needed. So you had people on family estates. In fact, Basil the Great and his sister, they had hermitages on their parents' estate. Makrina was the name of his sister. So that is the background, and the one who is normally thought of as the first desert father is Saint Anthony. Saint Anthony of the desert. But he wasn't the first. As I said, you already had these apotaktikoi there. And in fact, they were the ones who taught him. Yeah? The ones who were already, they taught Anthony about a life, the life of a hermit. He is thought of as the first because Athanasius, the bishop of Alexandria, wrote The Life of Anthony. So that, and that was a very popular book, and that actually then made him into the star of the desert. But he wasn't the first, and that's important to remember. But Athanasius in The Life says, Anthony's words persuaded many to take up the solitary life. And so from then on, there were monasteries in the mountains, and the desert was made a city by monks. Now, when they say monasteries, they don't mean the way we do that. Mone, the Greek word mone, just means solitary dwelling place. Yeah? That's where it comes from. Interestingly enough, because the life of Anthony was written by Athanasius, and Athanasius was a very, we would now call him a fundamentalist Christian. Yeah. And so in the life, there is no mention of contemplative prayer. There is no mention of oneness with God, because Athanasius wasn't into that. It's as simple as that. But in fact, if you look at the letters of Anthony, you get an entirely different picture. You see a man, even Athanasius makes him out as illiterate. Well, in fact, out of his letters, he comes out as highly educated, knowing Greek thought and philosophy. And actually, he went to dispute with the pagan philosophers. So he was actually a highly educated man. But we are used to this kind of spin doctoring. And in fact, Athanasius did a very good spin doctor job on Saint Anthony. Lots of the, you know, he talks about the importance, Anthony does, the importance of knowing ourselves as essentially good, not sinful. Whereas Athanasius makes him out as fighting all the time with his demons. Yeah? And he talks about insights coming from deep reading of scripture. So remember that sort of spin doctoring aspect of the life of Antony. He was a brilliant example, really. I also want to stress that there were women there. We've been, sorry for the men here, but we've been rubbed out of the accounts. Do you know that more than 50% of the hermits in the deserts were women? More than 50%. Yeah? And all we know now is about Amma Syncletica and Amma Theodora, because they were so powerful that their saying slipped into the men's text. But originally, the men and the women had their own sayings collected by their disciples. So that's something to keep in mind. Yeah? And in fact, the desert monks were known for going to the desert Ammas. The Abba, father, went to the Amma, the mother, for advice. There are lots of sayings that it's quite clear that that was the case. But, I mean, that would be another, I won't go into that, that would be a whole other story, perhaps, there. But it is important to remember. And the fact that even then there was discrimination, patriarchal society was there. Jesus was incredible and Paul to try and break through that patriarchal society. But because Gregory of Nyssa has to say, woman is in the image of God equally with man. The sexes are of equal worth. Their virtues are equal. Their struggles are equal. Would a man be able to compete with a woman who lives her life to the full? It's Gregory of Nyssa. Yeah? But the fact that he has to say it shows the attitude was not quite as exciting as before. So we have in the desert, first of all, the simple Coptic monks, yeah, the ones you hear about, Makarios, Moses, these were all Copts. And you have a group called the Originist monks, because they followed the teaching of Origen. So most of them, it's Evagrius is the big name there, and Cassian, his disciple, but there are many more. Arsenius, they were highly educated. Arsenius was in fact a tutor to the emperor and the emperor's children. Highly educated, so many of them. Now those were the mystically inclined one. Those are really our roots, the Originist monks. Yeah? And you can trace their influence from Clement in the second century, Clement, Origen, and then it goes into Evagrius and the Originist monks. Now, the normal Coptic ones, I said, if you have to put labels, then Athanasius would be our fundamentalist. Yeah, you take scripture literally and that's all. You're basically sinful. The only way you can be saved is through the intercession, the grace of Christ. Then you have the Originist monks who say, yes, that is true. You need to know your scripture. I mean, Origen wrote tomes and tomes. All his work was about explaining scripture. So scripture was equally important, but you went deeper, not just on the surface. You went to the other layers of meaning that scripture had. And their contemplation and theology went hand in hand. Evagrius is very known for the saying, a theologian is one who prays, and one who prays is a theologian. So now, theology and contemplation has been split, but originally they fed one another. Theology was making sense of the deep experience of contemplation. And the deep, deep reading of scripture. That's where the theology came from. So that is really, and so they then did not believe that we were essentially sinful. They believed, yep, you know, we have sinned, we have turned away from God, but we are essentially good and there is a link between us and God. Yeah, a direct link, which you could, through contemplation, there was the possibility with the grace of Christ always there of becoming one with the divine. So that were two different viewpoints, yeah? Pure faith and faith, but contemplation and deep listening to prayer added to that. But when we look at the actual sayings, there is no difference, because their sayings come not out of their theology, but out of their deep spiritual life. Yeah? So whereas on the surface they may be different, in the depth their teaching is the same. So that's interesting to remember. We may have different theologies, but in deep prayer we reach the same place. Now what was their... Is that all right? Shall I just wait, leave for a minute and see whether you have any questions on this part before I carry on? Anything that has jumped up and you're saying, I'm not sure about this. Any questions immediately?
The number of women hermits, is that all annotated in the archives or writing? Because that's incredible, and it's very unknown that there were so many women hermits. What texts?
I'm trying to remember, I can remember her first name, Laura, something or other, has recently written a book about the Desert Mothers. Mm-hmm. But yes, the records show that there was a metericon, as well as a patericon. Metericon meaning writings of the mothers. Yeah. And the problem with writings, and they found those in the desert, the problem with writings, they have to be copied. So eventually, if you don't want something, just don't allow it to be copied, and it disappears. But yes, I can't remember, Laura, the name will appear, more and more people are looking into the Desert Mothers, and this is documented, that they were so many of them were there. Yeah. And they were actually a lot braver than the men, because women had no right. They were either the property of their father or the chattel of their husband. Yeah. And the women in the desert were everything from very rich ladies who lived on the estates of the parents, or then into the desert. Some of them went into the desert. And there were prostitutes, there were ordinary women, there were men and wife, husband and wife would do it together, like Amun, who started the whole thing. He did it with his wife in the end. That's a funny story, actually. Amun started this whole movement to the desert. But then that happened because on his marriage night he had ascetic leanings, and he was married off by his uncle. You had no choices in those days. And on his wedding night, he spent the whole night convincing his wife that they ought to live as brother and sister. And she agreed. And then after 18 years of this, they both decided they wanted to live separate hermetical lives. I leave it to your imagination. But he then started this, you know, going to Antony was still alive, and he started building dwellings and people came and joined them. But it's often men, husband and wife as well, doing it. Yeah.
And this is the tradition of the famous St. Catherine of Alexandria that St. Catherine's monastery is named after.
Absolutely, absolutely. Women were incredibly powerful. I mean, I could do a whole morning on women in the church, and it's fascinating, fascinating. But I mustn't get distracted. One-pointed focus is meditation.
I did read a book on by a woman on virgins in Alexandria. Of course, Athanasius saw the monastic and ascetic as a way of getting a power base, but there were,
you're not kidding.
She was saying, in Alexandria, communities of women that, you know, that Athanasius was very keen to bring into, like, they're under his authority.
Great.
I think you also made a very good point that actually often women were actually pushed into these things,
yes,
by families. Of course, the reason that women were so absolutely powerful in the early church was the Christian community, like the Jews, did not practice either abortion or infanticide. Mm. So you had a huge number of women. In fact, this is one argument for the growth of the early church. Mm. There were so many women that pagans needed wives, and Christians had more women. So they would say, can I marry? And they would say, yes, of course you can, as long as you convert to
Christian. There you go. Yes, it's a fascinating time, but I mustn't go on this. I mean, the same thing people say, why are there so many women in spirituality now? It's the same. Same.
Yes.
Anyway, what was their daily... are you happy for me to carry on? Yeah? So what was their daily life? Like an excellent book by Dervis Chitty. In fact, he used the phrase... which I used a little while ago about a desert becoming a city. I think that's the title of his book, The Desert, a City by Dervas Chitty. And he said, the typical desert monk dwelt in a hut of stones covered with branches from a nearby oasis. Inside was a reed mat, because we're in the Nile Delta or near it anyway, a jar of water in which palm leaves were soaked for making mats, weaving ropes, a sheepskin for the cold of the night, and it is bitterly cold in the desert, a handful of dried peas or lentils, edible plants, peppers and capers. So quite basic. They lived in small groups, often their little cells around a courtyard. And one thing that often people say, oh, you know, this going into the desert is not exactly caring for your neighbor, is it? Well, Sister Benedicta Ward, who is really the authority on the subject of the Desert Fathers and Mothers, she observed that they were responsible for substantial agricultural improvement in the desert that benefited the life of the ordinary villagers around them. So they weren't just doing their own thing. You have Abba Or, who planted the whole marsh with trees. They had date palms, all for not for them, but for the villagers nearby. Another planted wheat, and the harvest was distributed among the poor. So they were very aware. It wasn't a sort of, you know, I mean, my ivory tower, never mind what happens to you. And also, they were consulted by everybody because they were known to have no axe to grind. So people would come from miles and miles, and they would be mediators. They would really be, you know, sort of, solving disputes. So these desert fathers and mothers were very involved in the life, but from this beautiful, detached, objective, no ego-driven kind of needs of power and control. So they were highly respected, very open to the needs of others. And although we heard that they eat sparingly, there is this lovely saying, our holy and most ascetic master stated that a monk and nun should always live as if he were to die on the morrow, but at the same time he should treat his or her body if they were to live on many more years to come. And that's wonderful, isn't it? Yes, keep death before your eye, but be sensible, folks. You know, look after your body as well. Don't overdo the fasting, and we will come to that in the second part of overdoing it. They also weren't just lotus eaters. They worked. Yeah, we saw that in the first one. They earned their own living. There was no way of handouts. They earned their own living. They wove mats, ropes, baskets. They hired themselves out as day laborers in the fields near the Nile. So they are really very industrious. And they combined ordinary working life with prayer. And that's where this whole idea of the repetition of a phrase as leading into prayer comes from. Yeah? You can repeat a phrase, whatever you're doing. And that's, in fact, the basis for our kind of teaching on meditation in the world community. Coming out of the desert, this repetition. So they prayed, they worked, they prayed. These were communities of lay people. That's the important thing to remember. That emphasis was on work and prayer. Liturgy played no role. That came later with people, you know, like Athanasius and later on. In fact, there is a saying is, stay away from bishops and women. So they were lay people whose life was focused on prayer. So how did they pray? There were three set periods during the day. You have, it was at the third hour, which is 9 o'clock, at the sixth hour, which was 12 o'clock, and at the ninth hour, which was 3 o'clock in the afternoon. 3 o'clock in the afternoon was always an important time for prayer. Do you remember in the Bible, Jesus said, when he said, come and see, to the first disciples, and they were with him, and it was 4 o'clock in the afternoon. The implication of that is they had prayed together. It always traditionally was a time of prayer. Now that's not all they did. Just listen to one of the Abbas saying, as for sleep at night, so about 6 o'clock, it would, you know, be roughly dark. As for sleep at night, pray 2 hours, beginning at evening, reckoning them from the sunset on. So sundown, very fast in the desert, pray for 2 hours. After you have praised God, sleep for 6 hours. Yeah? Then arise for the night watch and spend the remaining 4 hours in prayer till sunrise, which is 6 o'clock. Yeah? In summer, do the same with the hours curtailed and fewer psalms, though because of the shortness of the night. In fact, they used to say all the psalms in 24 hours.